Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Hi, I'm Dr. Scott Hahn, and I want to welcome you to The Road to Emmaus, a podcast from the St. Paul Center.
What is the answer to hotly debated questions on religious liberty, justice, and peace? Scott Hahn and Brandon McKinley offer eternal answers to today's political confusion in their new book, It Is Right and Just. Pre-order your copy today and learn more in our show notes at stpaulcenter.com/road.
I'm really excited today to introduce a special guest, Dr. Dirya Little. She's well known as the author of a book that Ignatius Press recently published entitled From Islam to Christ: One Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God. She's also the author of another book that has come out recently, A Beginner's Guide to the Traditional Latin Mass. So her journey continues, and this one is written for little kids. Just a little background. Born and raised in Muslim Turkey, Dirya Little rejected her family's Islamic faith and became an atheist after her parents' divorce. During her stormy adolescence, she tried to convince a Christian that there is no God, but was converted to Christ instead. During her doctoral studies in Durham, England, she entered the Catholic Church. Nowadays, she lives in a small town in Pennsylvania with her husband, Virgil, and four children, enjoying coffee, kissing boo-boos, and writing about the world that she imagined. And she can be found at DiryaLittle.com. Social media. Dirya, it is so great to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Well, I know you have shared your story in the past, and you're going to be doing it again in the future, because I invited you to share your testimony to our summer conference, Defending the Faith. But why don't we begin sort of in the beginning? You know, how was it for you to start off on a journey that took you someplace you never thought you'd end up going?
Well, I think like many people, I did not want to be on this journey, but the Lord is faithful and he pursues us and he finds us where we are. For me, it started in Turkey, about, as you know, 5,000 miles east of here. And my parents were nominal Muslims. Turkey is a little different if you know the history as far as Muslim countries go. After the First World War, it became very secular. And when the Turkish Republic was founded. So on the outside, if you go to Turkey, it changed a lot in the recent years, but it looks Western, especially in the big cities. But on the inside, it's still very Muslim, especially the social norms. For me, I lived in a smallish kind of town. I grew up, and both my parents were, of course, Muslims. And I didn't know anybody else who weren't a Muslim. So what would happen was, at home, we learned how to pray the Muslim prayers, memorize bits and pieces of the Quran. And then at school, we will learn all these Western ideals of liberal democracy, secularism and such. So it's kind of like a country stuck in between the East and the West. And I was kind of part of that. But a big part of Turkish national identity is being Muslim. And since it's kind of the... it follows in the footsteps of the Ottoman Empire, we have that imperial pride, and the British may know. Americans don't, but I think...
They sure don't.
It may get there yet. So we have... So being a Muslim is a big part of that, our identity. So as I grew up, I learned how to read the Quran in Arabic. I don't speak Arabic because, you know, in Turkey, we speak Turkish. We memorized the prayers. I learned how to pray the prayer. We fasted for Ramadan even as little children. And I was all happy, and I didn't know any better, you know. And one of the things I like to usually mention is that our... Because we were exporting all these Western ideals, especially about women. My mother worked. She was a nurse. And my father worked. But because the society was still Muslim, even though my mother had all these freedoms that many women from Muslim countries didn't enjoy, she had to still come back home and be the wife my father wanted her to be. Like, she had to cook 3 different kinds of meals a day. And she was in charge of all the household tasks still. So she struggled a lot with this. But she had to work and still be the perfect wife. And that's how my childhood was. I didn't know any better. I didn't seek any better until my parents divorced.
How common was divorce in Turkish culture at that point?
Not that common. It's a lot more common. It's one of those things, again, we import, we export from, no, import yeah. from the West. So it's a lot more common now. But I, my parents were the only parents I knew who got a divorce. But my father was a ladies' man, and it's kind of, it's almost common for a man to have mistresses on the side, but they are like expected to do it kind of hidden, right, not blatantly. And they had, my mother decided to divorce my father when he just wanted to have another wife, basically. Yeah. So, which is...
It's interesting because what you're describing in my ears sounds like a cultural tension between Western secularism or liberal, politics on the one side, and yet the Turkish custom of identifying themselves, not just with the Ottoman Empire and all of that pride, but Islamic faith is what defines so much of the culture there. Mm-hmm. And again, beyond the city of Istanbul and, you know, out in the country. But you were living that. It was a personal tension. It wasn't just, you know, a cultural phenomenon that you find throughout mm-hmm. Turkey. It was something that was dividing your own household and your own experience growing up.
Right. And it's kind of hard for Westerners to understand how this tension affects a family's life. And this is how it happens. And I think that's one of the reasons divorce rates are going up, because in a way the Turkish women are awakening that Islam doesn't treat them well, but the only other option they know is the Western feminism. So like it as if there is there they can there's nothing else other than these two bad choices, and here we are, like we have a lot, like a higher divorce rate. Or but for me, again, my parents' divorce was a really big break. And I think it can be said even in the West too. We always talk about how resilient children are, but we are not.
Right.
Yes, and we need the parents, even as imperfect as my family's life was. That's all I knew. That was my world. And when my father left for this new lady, I felt very betrayed by my parents.
How old were you at that point?
Their marriage started to shake. I was around 11, and by 12, my father was gone. Divorce was finalized. So it's very bad timing.
Oh, yeah.
Too.
What a hinge moment for, you know, a preteen young mm-hmm. lady. Yeah. So what happened next? How do you connect that to kind of embracing atheism?
This happens again. I think this happens in the West too.
That's more common than people usually acknowledge.
Yes, because what happens is I trusted everything they told me, and now, especially their love.
Right.
And now one is gone, gone after this woman. And my mother went into this depression, and basically she was absent. She was physically there, but emotionally and otherwise completely absent. So suddenly it's like everything that I stood on kind of crumbled under me. So I started to question everything they taught me, and religion kind of goes in there too. And I think it happens to Christian families too. Like, you know, children of divorce are.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially when religion divides parents, kids, I think, unconsciously resent the religion. Either one, if they see it dividing their parents, because intuitively, unconsciously, I think kids, we all feel as though you look at your parents and that's the source of your identity, the source of your life. And then when it breaks apart, you just feel torn asunder.
Exactly. So that's where, very first time I started to question Islam. Again, one of the things we emphasize a lot in Christianity, that God is our father, but in Islam, that's unthinkable. So we are raised with this servile fear. I talk about it in From Islam to Christ, because it's, again, very hard to understand in the West, that you grow up with this fear towards God, that he could punish you or hurt you anytime because of your sin or insolence. As one of the anecdotes I tell, I was a little girl, 6, 7, and we were always told that you could never imagine, picture, depict Allah or Muhammad. And as a little girl, I was imagining Allah as this rainbow eyes and floaty, ghostly kind of creature. And it was kind of a momentary lapse of judgment. And once I realized what I was doing, I was filled with fear. So 4 days I waited to be struck down or turned into a boulder. Like, I was crippled with this fear. So as we grow up with this fear, we never question Islam. So it becomes like, that's why I think one of the reasons it's very hard to convert Muslims, because this fear becomes part of the religion and you don't even realize that it's there.
Yeah, I want to press pause for a moment and just give our listeners an opportunity to feel the force of what you're saying, because we don't know how to think that way. Yet when you're raised in that kind of culture, you don't know how to think any other way except right. that. And so there is a God, Allah. It's a master-slave relationship mm-hmm. and nothing more. And so while there is reverence and worship, it's primarily in terms of submission mm-hmm. and obedience. It isn't the trust of a child in a loving father. It really is a kind of an authoritarian religion in that sense. And so for us to inherit Christianity, even if it's watered down and distorted, you know, that parent-child relationship is so basic, you know, that we kind of assume or project that onto other religions. We assume that, you know, we all believe in God, and so there are all variations of this sort of thing, mm-hmm. when in fact it's quite different. I won't go into it, but I share with you in the past what it was like for me to encounter that in a dialogue over breakfast with a Muslim scholar, and he made it very clear that to call Allah Father is the essence of blasphemy.
Right.
To call ourselves children of God is the flip side. That's also blasphemous.
Mm-hmm. It's unthinkable for Muslims. And that servile fear runs so deep. When I was studying American history for the first time, I heard all these Americans say, it's like, I don't understand, why didn't the slaves rise up against their masters? I'm like, you have no idea the strength of servile fear. It's completely crippling. So that's why they didn't rise. Like, as a person who grew up Muslim, I'm like, I understand why they didn't rise up, because it is like, it's not only intellectually crippling, but it's also physically. That's why they didn't rise up. And that's why, like, most Muslims don't dare question Islam. And to be honest, Muhammad and Islam needs that kind of fear to stay afloat.
That's right. Because it's not the same as filial fear, as theologians in the Christian mm-hmm. tradition would call it, because, you know, children have a fear also when it comes to their relationships with their parents, and it could be unhealthy. But even in a healthy relation, you have a fear of offending your mother or your father, because you trust them and you want to please them. And so You know, in a loving relationship, a little fear goes a long way. Eventually, as we read in 1 John, perfect love casts out all fear. Mm-hmm. But whose love is perfect? That's only on the other side of the veil. So there is servile fear, the fear of slaves, and then there is filial fear, the fear of children. And they might seem related, and I suppose they're not entirely disconnected, because in relationship to our Creator God, we really are servants. Mm-hmm. We find out that God, as our Creator, cares for us better than most parents do for their kids. And so it kind of opens the door to being made children and having that childlike trust. But Islam not only closes the door, it locks it, it seals it off,
right,
in a way that most non-Muslims don't fully appreciate.
Right. And St. Thomas explains this really well, a bit the relationship with the servile fear and the filial fear. Servile fear isn't necessarily evil or bad,
right,
but it always needs to lead to the filial fear. It's like when I tell my three-year-old, don't touch the stove, she touches it, she goes to touch it, and I said, no, don't touch the stove. I slap her hand, then she's afraid of me. So that's servile fear, because
the fear
she knows.
Yes,
yes, fear of punishment, like we say in the act of contrition, right?
Right?
So, but then hopefully as she grows up, she realizes, oh, my mother told me not to touch the stove because she loves me.
That's right.
And that should turn into filial fear.
The breakthrough, yes.
Yes. And so if it stays as a servile fear, it's imperfect and it's never fulfilled. And, you know, sometimes as parents, maybe we fall into that trap, but it should always needs to, like, again, in the act of contrition, like we want to be contrite, not because of fear of hell, but because I have offended you, my Lord.
Attrition and contrition come together.
Right.
So go back with me for a second. How old were you when you woke up, looked in the mirror and said, I'm an atheist?
I kind of fell into atheism rather than, so I rejected Islam once I started reading the Quran for the first time. Like, I had memorized big sections of it in Arabic, but we are never encouraged to read it in our own language. When I read it for the first time in Turkish, and then I read Muhammad's life and the Hadith and his sayings and such, like, I can't believe I believe in this. Because once again, once that wall of fear is broken, you realize, like, I don't want to follow this man. Like, as a woman, it's not possible for me to be like him, because Muhammad is depicted as the ideal man. Everybody needs to be just like him. It's almost like we're trying to be
Every
just
man
like Christ.
Has to, yes, but a, like, woman really can't.
Yeah. It's like, I don't think I have the necessary bodily parts to be like him. You know, it's, of course, and that's one of the things that how different men and women were treated, and the place of violence. If you read Muhammad's life, it's really violent.
And that isn't slanderous or even critical. That's an empirical historical fact that Muslims, in all honesty, were readily acknowledged.
Right. I mean, that's one of the things. I had never heard that Islam was a religion of peace until I moved to America. Like, Muslims don't. Like, peace is not an end in itself. Like, that's not, they don't care about a peaceful world, you know. They want to have the peace of heaven. Or,
right,
you know, what, so, but that was very striking for me, how unjust, it was, yeah, the women's place and violence was very hard for me to stomach. So I was like, okay, I'm not Muslim anymore. What else is there? But, thankfully the Lord had created me as a geek. I read a lot. I loved, you know, reading about science and such. And the more I read, and because I didn't have any other access to any other religion other than Buddhism and such, but they all seemed very silly to me back then, I kind of fell into atheism, because I thought all religions,
yes,
were just like sky, God. We're just going to invent this to kind of dominate other people or make ourselves feel better. So I kind of fell into it, and I really held on to it, because now atheism became my faith in a way that, you know, I just wanted to justify everything through that. I'd say I was about 13 or 14.
And how old were you when you encountered your first Christian?
I was 19.
Wow.
So I went through middle school, high school, convinced that I knew everything under the sun, as all teenagers do. And so when I went to college, this is in Ankara, Turkey, I had to get a job, which is very uncommon in Turkey, because the parents support their children, which wasn't the case in my case. And I met this lady who was a 5.0 Calvinist.
That's my tribe.
Yeah.
I know that.
So,
well, the evangelical reformed Calvinist, yes.
She's come a long time way, bless her. But when I when I met her, I didn't know that, but she was there as a missionary. But that's again, like, they don't even use the term missionary because they think all Christians are CIA agents, as if CIA is that organized or efficient, that is. But she was raised in an atheist family, and she had converted while she was going to university. And she and her husband had a great job, and they left all of that behind to preach the gospel in a place like Turkey. And I, unfortunately for her, the first person, one of the first people she met was me. They had just moved. So I saw this little ad, American lady looking for someone who can speak English to teach her Turkish. So I knock on her door. She opens the door. I mean, this is like Turkey, right? Muslim country. She opens it, and there is a verse cross-stitched right across the entrance door. That should tell everything. So she hired me as a tutor, and that was the very first time I ever heard what actually Christians believed, because we were taught Christians believed in three gods, Father, Son, and the Mother. And they had four different Bibles, and then the different Gospels. They thought they were four different books, because remember, Islam teaches that the Bible was corrupted.
That's right.
By Christians. So it's like, that was the very first time I actually heard. And I was so lucky that she was very kind of intellectual and pushy, which really annoyed me at the time. But I think the Lord knew that that's what I needed, like somebody to kind of push my buttons and annoy me. Because I would go back to my dorm and it's like, clearly there's some smart atheist who can refute this stuff she's saying, and I couldn't find anything. Then I would go back and we would argue more. And she was also the first pro-life person I've ever met, because Islam doesn't have really a clear teaching on those issues. And she was very consistent and persistent. And she knew her religion. She knew Islam well. It was just beautiful 3.5 years.
Providential. It was no misfortune for her to meet you. Now, how long did that teaching her Turkish last?
So I saw her twice a week, 2.5 hours a day, for 3.5 years before I came even close.
So you were in your early 20s and you were still teaching her, in effect.
Yes, because I lost a few years because I had to move cities and such. I was in my third year in college when I finally converted. But she wasn't there actually. She was here in for sabbatical when I converted. But that kind of made me believe that it was possible that God existed. So for me, if God exists, that's a big deal. Like I was never a relativist. Oh, you believe in that. And I believe in this. I'm like,
it matters.
It does matter. So because if there's God, that means there's eternal life. Then everything we do here in this life is kind of goes away like that. And it's just, and it could have eternal meanings. And I'm like, and it may not be pleasant, but truth is important. I always believed that there was one truth. And you know what? Maybe atheism was making my life miserable, but it's okay, because truth is worth being miserable for. Like,
right.
You can't just lie to yourself. Like, so that's what I was thinking with her. And when she made me read about the historical accounts, you know, that Bible wasn't changed and Jesus was a real person and all these, like, you know, Lee Strobel kind of...
Right.
stuff. And that was very eye-opening for me. I'm like, if this is all true, then I have to do something with it. But with her, after...
And by the way, Lee Strobel is an evangelical that we all appreciate. I mean, the case for Christ, the case for creation, that sort of thing. He's great. I've gotten to know him a little bit. Now, had you already graduated from college at this point?
No. So this is... this at the end of my second year, and... I should have graduated, but I lost 2 years, as I said. So she leaves to come to America, and I didn't have any money. I didn't have a job. It was kind of really messy. I think it was one of those times the devil is like, oh, she's getting too close, you know, do something. And again, the Lord, in his providence, he introduced me to a family, and they asked me to teach their kids, who were, I think, 4 and 7, little kids, which is a completely different way of seeing the Christian life. Because remember, I'm still very emotionally wounded then. Right. Like, okay, like I'm thinking all of these good things about Christianity here, but what does that mean? Like it just never quite traveled, you know, from head to heart, so to speak. And when I witnessed their Christian life, that was a big leap forward for me because...
Yeah, you just pointed to two really big things that we don't notice quite often, and that is friendship. You know, as you develop a friendship with someone who's intelligent, who's articulate, mm-hmm. you know, you're teaching them, but they're teaching you, and there's pushback, but above all, it's in the context of friendship, so you can see the evidence for Scripture. But then the second thing is not just friendship, but family life. Mm-hmm. And you know, the fact that it can make a difference, especially for people who are still living with those wounds and looking for something to kind of overcome.
I was so sure they were faking the whole thing.
Wow.
I mean, I had never seen, because Islam creates very dysfunctional families. So I try to explain it again, this relationship between Allah and a Muslim, that servile relationship, it trickles down into the way the society is structured. So the husband is the master of the wife, right? Like there is no... they're both created in the image of God.
Yeah, in Islam, there is no notion, no doctrine of being, of bearing the image and likeness of God. No creature bears Allah's image.
No, again, unthinkable, blasphemy right. all day long.
It's, and Christians just like, it's the air we breathe. We don't even think about it, you know.
And it makes a huge difference in the society we create. Because
and the marriages, yes.
Right. Like, you know, I love my husband and he loves me like Christ loved the church, who also died for the church. Like, it's like this kind of... It's unthinkable. And I had never seen a functional marriage within the Christian context. And I babysat and I all that stuff, but I was just teaching the children was completely different because I was really immersed in the family life and I witnessed. And I'm like, nobody's this happy. Like, as soon as I leave, I bet they start bickering and fighting. Like, I was just really, but at the same time, I was really attracted to their family life. So, like, I remember a few times they had to ask me to leave because it was like 11 o'clock. I'm like, I just wanted to be there.
You're drawing life and strength from being with them.
Exactly. Yeah. I like the real world, like seemed very bitter and dark. So that was another step that I
and
needed.
And they were Christian. Because,
yes.
And their faith was part of the fabric of their lives. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were non-denominational. So.
How long was that? I mean, how long was the period where you tended for those two
that
kids?
Wasn't long at all, which is... So I started teaching them in August and I converted in October. So it wasn't that long because I think intellectually I was there, but that emotional step was big and I still couldn't make the decision. I was going to a very good university in Turkey and I probably was going to get a very good job in one of the government ministries. It was just, you know, finally I was going to be free from this financial constraints. It was, I couldn't make up my mind. I mean, I just couldn't. I just kept thinking about it. And I had I was engaged back then and my boyfriend was an atheist. All my friends were atheists. We sat around drinking, making fun of stupid people who believed in God. And, you know, it was going to be such an awkward conversation. It was like, hey, by the way, I became a Christian, which sounds crazy, you know. It sounds foolish. So I couldn't make up my mind. Like I was like at this, you know, line and I couldn't cross it by myself. And you probably heard this from converts from Islam, that there's all these like dreams and visions and all these like supernatural interventions. And for me, like I've never kind of believed any mystical experiences and such because, again, skeptic is always there. I've gotten better. But one day I was going to class and really early morning and I had this scene of, I was awake. I had this scene, just like outdoors, mighty mountains in the backyard. And there's a little girl sitting in the middle of it, like a green meadow wearing white. And she's looking down and playing with these little toys in her lap. And then these two hands from the sky come down. And these hands are so big, you can only see like up to the wrist. And the little girl is so tiny compared to these two hands. And the hands are handing down this big gift, but it's not like, you can tell that it's not like a material gift. It's like glowy, shiny. It's like beyond the understanding of this little girl. She doesn't even see that this gift is being handed to her because she's really busy playing with her little toys. So finally she sees it. She looks up and she says, "No, thank you. I have these little things to play with." So I'm like, are you stupid? Like, how can you even compare your tiny, tiny trinkets to this amazing gift that you, it's beyond your comprehension? Then I'm like, oh, wait, that little girl is me.
What a gentle revelation.
It is, isn't it? Because like, it's not like a, it's not like a slap, because that's what I needed. It was like, look, you're thinking about these silly things, your friends, your job, your fiance. It's like nothing compared to this, what I am offering to you.
Now, give me a sense here. Are you in your mid-20s at this point?
So I'm 22.
Okay, so early 20s. Mm-hmm. And so you meet this family around August, and by October
mm-hmm.
you were baptized or what?
Well, baptism, I still didn't get baptized till May, because they always want to make sure that we convert for right reasons. So right. I had to go sure. through with stuff. But so the following day, I go to this brand new family in Turkey. The mom was washing the dishes, and I said, I think this is a good day to become a Christian.
Oh,
and this is like very hard, because they come to Turkey. It's like, you're probably never going to see a convert. And they're like, 3 months later, here I am. But like, they kind of reap the benefits of the efforts of the previous lady who's in America by that time. So, but that's when, so that's when I became Protestant again. Was baptized the following May, full immersion. I have no doubt that my baptism was valid.
I want to press pause here, summarize, and then take a break, because we want to come back in another installment and hear the rest of the story, because this is enthralling. I just want to summarize by saying, you're raised in Turkey in a Muslim family, and you sort of live the dysfunction of aspects of that faith. In the relationship that you have with your parents, they divorce, and that creates a seismic rift in your own psyche, you know, as a child. And so atheism for years, and then through friendship with someone who you're teaching the Turkish language to, and then family life. And I just want to conclude by pointing out the obvious, that we never know how much God can use things like friendship, family life, conversations where you discuss what is true and what isn't, you know. But it's not just a kind of classroom setting. It isn't just, you know, an intellectual exchange. It really involves interpersonal relationships and life, real life. And I just want to conclude by saying, never underestimate what it means for you who are listening to just reach out and ask someone for coffee or lunch or spend time with them. And not just to get their scalp or to convert them, but just for the sake of friendship. And also open up your home, because when people experience family life, it doesn't have to be the Holy Family in Nazareth, but when they have real respect and love and trust, a little can go a long way. Mm-hmm. And I've got to say, I want to go a long way. I want to go the rest of the way. But I know that podcasts aren't supposed to last as long as I would personally like them to last. So why don't we press pause here and then come back later. And I just want to say to our listeners, you've been listening to Dr. Duriya Little, who is the author of From Islam to Christ, One Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God. It's a book that when you pick it up, you will not put it down until you're done. She's also the author of a more recent book, A Beginner's Guide to the Traditional Latin Mass, that I appreciate because I'm just discovering that myself. And it's written so that kids can also discover it too. So you have been with us on The Road to Emmaus, a podcast from the St. Paul Center. But please be sure to join us, because we're going to pick up right where we leave off at the end of this session, at the very next one. So, Lord, please bless Duriya and Virgil and their kids, and bless all of our listeners, too, that they might be open to the truth of Christ and the Holy Spirit. For we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.
The Road to Emmaus podcast is a production of the St. Paul Center. To learn more about this episode, visit our show notes at stpaulcenter.com/road. Our production team includes producer and director Beckett Gitto, associate producer Molly Trainer, audio engineer and editor Joseph Palmer. Our host is Dr. Scott Hahn. Subscribe and rate The Road to Emmaus wherever you find this podcast. The St. Paul Center is a nonprofit organization facilitating life-changing encounters with the living Word of God. To find more faith-based resources, visit stpaulcenter.com.
Finding someone on an online Catholic dating site shouldn't be like shopping for a blender. So why do most dating sites leave you feeling like you're shopping for a spouse? At Catholic Singles, we connect members through our unique user polls and activities, which help you discover other members and their personalities and interests. Because you're a person, not a profile picture. So stop shopping and start discerning. Trust your love story to the original Catholic dating site and use the promo code BREADBOX at checkout for 20% off at catholicsingles.com.